Going to now move to panel five, the DSR and energy efficiency experts. And first will be Mr. Pearson on behalf of the E-Cubed Company, LLC. And I believe, Mr. Pearson, you will also be presenting on behalf of the National Association of Energy Service Companies. Is that correct?
That's correct. Don Gilligan couldn't be here today. Fortunately, he had a birth in his family last evening, so that took precedence.
All right, you're going to have to speak up and pull the microphone closer. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Thank you for allowing us to speak today. As was just said, my name is Arthur Pearson. I work with a firm called the EQ Company.
You're going to have to pull the microphone closer and speak up, please.
I work for a firm called the EQ Company. We're energy consultants specializing in regulatory affairs. We currently are appearing before commissions in New York State, Maine, Vermont, and Massachusetts on various matters. And the group that I'm actually representing is a group called the Joint Supporters, which is a composite organization of energy equipment manufacturers, installation firms, engineering groups, and also end users. And what I wanted to speak to you today about was the benefits that combined heat and power, combined heat and power, can offer the state.
You'll have to speak up a little bit more, okay. Please.
As was said earlier, at present time, there are what's separately producing electricity and then producing heat is very wasteful. In fact, a recent study that was produced by the Energy Information Administration showed that out of 21 quadrillion BTUs produced for homes last year, approximately 10 quadrillion of them, or 47%, never reached the home and never produced useful energy. So it's showing that it's an extremely wasteful to separately produce electricity and heat. And so the prime benefit of microcombined heat and power and combined heat and power is that by generating them jointly, you're saving on fuel. And specifically, doing so can save anywhere from 25 to 35% of the fuel that would be otherwise used by producing these two energy sources separately. Microcombined heat and power and cogeneration can also provide additional benefits besides that, including improved reliability on the grid, improved power quality, and also they can be utilized in demand response programs very effectively. Now, looking at Pennsylvania, for example, if 1,000 1.2 kilowatt microcombined heat and power units were installed in the state, it would be the equivalent of taking off the streets 726 passenger cars, or the equivalent carbon storage that would be could otherwise be stored by a 906-acre forest. So, in terms of our recommendations, we believe that in any programs that are developed, first fuel savings, which is what we call the fuel that would be used to produce either electricity or heat, should be taken into account in establishing any programs, that microcombined heat and power and combined heat and power systems should be included in any programs that are developed, and that in any TRC tests that are developed, the emissions benefits that any system or program developed should be included. In concluding, if we took the 10 quadrillion BTUs that are otherwise wasted, and if 20% of the homes utilize the microcombined heat and power system, with a 25% fuel savings, you would reduce the BTUs needed by 500 trillion. In Pennsylvania, there are roughly 132,000 furnaces and boilers installed each year. If 20% of them used microcombined heat and power, that would be approximately 26,500 units, which would produce over 31 megawatts of electricity. In conclusion, we believe that such a BTU demand reduction would greatly improve emissions, would make a significant stride in achieving the goal of energy independence, would provide economic benefits, and would enhance national security. Thus concludes my remarks with respect to combined heat and power. Now, as was stated earlier, I'm also going to make a brief presentation for the National Association of Energy Service Companies, NASCO. The industry currently delivers approximately $5 billion worth of projects annually across the country. In Pennsylvania alone, the industry is responsible for about $300 million worth of projects. The industry is composed of manufacturers, energy suppliers, and independent companies. If you look at slide 4, you can see the industry has been growing greatly over the last few years. And then the following slide, what NASCO believes is that energy service companies, or conservation service providers, to use the local term, have tremendous abilities that have been demonstrated now for many years and can be used to enhance any programs that are developed by the utilities across the state. They have significant state expertise. There isn't the need for redundant delivery systems with the utilities creating independent programs without utilizing the use of ESCOs, and that incentives should be provided to the ESCOs to deliver these services. Finally, NASCO believes that the best planning processes would include all stakeholders in a true collaborative process, that the details of the program is where it's most important to work out the details as clearly as possible, and that Pennsylvania doesn't need to start from scratch, that they can utilize the expertise that the ESCOs have developed over many years to implement the best programs possible. Thank you.
Next, we will hear from Mr. Greg Thomas on behalf of PA Home Energy.
I think we're waiting for the... there it is. Down just like that. There you go. Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. Next slide. PA Home Energy is a statewide program that has been developed by the West Penn Power Sustainable Energy Fund with its administrator, Joel Morrison, who's testified before you before about this program.
You're going to have to speak up, please.
The PA Home Energy program is a statewide Energy Star-based program for new and existing homes that was developed by West Penn Power Sustainable Energy Fund and its program administrator, Joel Morrison, who has testified before you previously. Next. PA Home Energy and the Energy Star programs that it is based on emphasize the house as a system principle. And this is very, very similar to what Commissioner Hanger referenced as whole building approach. This is critical because these programs are all fuel programs. They address both electricity and gas because that's what the houses are using. That's what consumers are making decisions upon. The other aspect of a house as a system approach is it provides an opportunity to combine health and safety, building durability, comfort, with energy efficiency. So you're able to bundle all those sources of value and stimulate more consumer investment in efficiency because you're able to provide so many different kinds of services at once. And performance testing is key to that. This is a market transformation program. In other words, its emphasis is on changing the way that companies do business, changing the way that consumers understand and seek out services. So it's trying to accomplish some fundamental change. It references national certifications. It doesn't try to develop a local certification. It's referencing national programs like ResNet and BPI. That's critical because of the credibility it gives the program, and it gives the program leverage in terms of whatever happens on a national level. We're prepared for that if there's a national standard that comes out. We're targeting being able to coordinate with those kinds of possibilities. It's the best opportunity for linking with those national programs. It's an infrastructure development program. We've emphasized in the first year training and certifying contractors, individuals, and the lower bar, the white bar there, is actually the companies, the Pennsylvania-based companies, who have changed their business model and are starting to offer these services across the territory. So these are companies who have invested and continue to make more and more investments in these programs. Next. You can see from this map sort of the distribution of the trainings and the people around the various areas where we've held the trainings across the state. One of the key ideas here was also introduced earlier, which is the idea of a deep energy savings program versus broad energy savings. And there are differences there, and really I think one of the critical questions in terms of how utilities will mitigate their risk is finding combinations of these things that work. And similar to the previous presenter, the devil is in the details and how these programs coordinate with each other. In a broad program, you're trying to serve lots of different houses at a very easy to obtain level. In a deep program, you're creating change in the marketplace. You're creating companies. You're driving investment, and it takes longer. But once those companies have been created and they're operating in the marketplace, they continue to provide those services for an indefinite period. Whereas under a broad program that's simply driven by incentives, the incentives go away and the activity goes away. Next. One of the other critical issues that's been addressed previously is information flow. Feedback is critical to how these programs can improve their savings and their operations. So the idea that information flow about energy use, both pre- and post-retrofit, is critical to our ability to evolve these programs towards greater and greater savings.
You have 30 seconds.
Other key concepts are the idea. Deem savings is very complex as it relates to a whole house program and particularly consumer ed programs. Service providers need stages of training to be able to enter into these models. The idea that there's a portfolio approach where you can mix different types of programs. And finally, the TRC question. In my written testimony, I provide some very explicit examples as to how the TRC affects this. Effectively, the TRC is biased against capital investment. The deeper a consumer makes an investment, the more the TRC is biased against that. And for example, equipment replacement. If I replace a furnace that is 30 years old, the TRC would, under standard practice, would include that cost as the full cost of that unit. Whereas the consumer is actually making an investment in transferring the equipment to a newer model that they would have had to have made anyway. So how do we create evaluation programs, evaluation practices? And I point in our testimony to a couple different instances. California is addressing this in terms of how you reduce the cost. There's sort of two sides to this. You can reduce the cost or you can try to claim additional benefits that, like comfort. It's generally easier to reduce the cost side of the equation because it's a more of a known value. Measure life is another thing. There's been this issue around a five-year measure life, and that's really devastating to any kind of capital improvement or deep savings program. So basically, there's a lot of opportunity here, but it has to be carefully crafted, and we think we have a strong program model that's on the ground and has reduced a lot of costs already. Thank you.
Next, we have Mr. Johnston Ball from the Westmoreland County Cooperative Extension.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. On behalf of Penn State University's Cooperative Extension, I want to offer my appreciation for the opportunity to be here to present some testimony this afternoon. The legislation, we believe, is extremely timely and of utmost importance as our organization, Penn State University and the Cooperative Extension Outreach, focuses a statewide effort to educate consumers of all classes on supports the implementation of conservation and renewable energy technologies while the Commonwealth begins its transition toward a sustainable energy marketplace. As background, Penn State Cooperative Extension functions, we are uniquely positioned to participate in this effort because of our longstanding presence in every county of the Commonwealth. Specifically, Cooperative Extension has had fully staffed functioning offices on a county-by-county basis that have cultivated long-standing relationships with local governing bodies, trade organizations, service groups, and communities by and large on a variety of levels, and have been in the business of providing local programming and support for many decades. We think leveraging these experiences will well-developed and respected relationships in pursuit of the successful implementation of Act 129 is really a natural fit for Cooperative Extension. The importance of moving toward this sustainable energy marketplace, Penn State, which is a top 15 research institution in terms of annual budgets in the United States, has made a major philosophical and financial commitment toward successful long-term outcomes. My position at Cooperative Extension as an educator of renewable energy development is an example of the commitment that the Commonwealth has to move the Commonwealth's energy marketplace in the direction of sustainability. I was about 3 years and 11 months ago, I was before this commissioners, I believe it wasn't with any of the current tenured commissioners, and we were meeting in a similar environment, talking about our experience in the first real-time pilot program that took place in Pennsylvania, real-time pricing pilot program that was implemented in Pennsylvania from the years 2002 through 2005. Those experiences are long forgotten, but Penn State, with its foresight, has retained that legacy, that experience of having administered and worked with real-time pricing through that period. So that's an example of the foresight that Penn State has in retaining that kind of information and experience that was long lost on the utilities that were actually involved, or the utility that was actually involved in that program over that period. Going forward, we respectfully request the Commission reflect on the outcomes of those efforts, like the demand-side working group, the demand-side response working group. Under the directive of Act 129, there are now prescriptive outcomes with strict penalties if these measures aren't met. We are at this juncture today because the efforts, the voluntary efforts that we went through back in the early parts of this decade, were unsuccessful, and it was largely because there wasn't the spirit, the commitment, or the manpower invested to make those things happen. We believe today we've got a different mandate. We believe with Penn State's research and background and experience and exposure, we can be much more successful in moving these efforts forward successfully. Cooperative Extension suggests that the programs that are introduced or under consideration be varied. We have a very diverse Commonwealth here, where natural gas is readily available in certain portions of the state and totally unattainable in other areas of the state, as an example. So we need to have programs tailored to the clientele and the availability of resources in the different areas of the state.
You have 30 seconds.
When considering central heating and cooling, we think that a focus on geothermal should be a direct made available or a program incentive to be made available across the Commonwealth. We're very appreciative of the opportunity to share our vision and emphasize our strengths with the Commission and the staff and other interested parties. We're looking forward to defining a role for the cooperative extension with the potential of raising the value of every dollar invested towards securing Pennsylvania's sustainable energy future while leveraging the trust and relations of the constituents that have spent years in developing. Thank you very much for this opportunity to present.
Thank you. Next, we have Mr. Birnbaum from the Current Group, LLC.
Thank you. Is this on?
Yes, you'll have to hold it close.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and fellow commissioners. I'd like to address my comments to energy, alternative energy sources, energy efficiency, and demand response tools, but one in particular that really is not fully addressed by Act 129, and that's what's now known as the smart grid. Current is a company based in nearby Maryland. We provide high-speed two-way communications networks with embedded sensing for utilities. These networks are overlaid on the existing electric distribution grid to transform those grids into automated real-time operating systems. We're presently supporting smart grid deployments in Dallas, Texas, and Boulder, Colorado, those with Encore and Xcel Energy, respectively. A smart grid is essentially overlaying a communications network with embedded sensing, and as one of the speakers said this morning, computing power to enable the utility to analyze in real time what's happening in its network and actually program much of the network for automated responses, whether that be for outages, for potential outages that can be restored, and inefficient operations throughout the grid that cost us all money as ratepayers. In particular, a smart grid investment will produce net savings for ratepayers. This is in contrast to many meter-centric or smart meter systems that actually don't produce positive savings for all consumers. They may, to the extent consumers actually can engage in demand response programs. But some experts have estimated that a full smart grid deployment can achieve as much as 10 times the benefits as a dedicated standalone smart meter system. And this is not to suggest that a smart grid system is exclusive of the other smart meters. On the contrary, that a smart grid system would support distributed generation, demand response, certainly smart meters, but also automating the distribution grid itself. Just by way of an example, we think that a 1 million home deployment or 1 million meter deployment of a smart grid can actually achieve up to $3 billion in benefits over a 17-year life of the program. The net benefits of that on a present value basis, in excess of the actual cost to deploy and operate the network, would be about $750 million. And these are revenues and returns that can be used to obviously reduce rates, to enable the utility company to further upgrade its grid, and to reward the utility for modernizing and taking these efficiency measures. In contrast, many meter-based solutions are essentially revenue neutral to revenue negative, at least for the end user. To the extent they become net present value positive, they usually rely upon demand response programs, which assume certain levels of behavioral changes by end users, and B, often fail to include the costs of the devices consumers need to put in their homes. For instance, some of the pilots going on today reveal that to put a programmable thermostat in one's home can cost as much as $300 to $400 when you include the cost of the thermostat and then the electrician you have to arrange to come install it inside your house. In particular, with respect to Act 129, the Act requires utilities, and actually permits utilities, to change out meters, as you know, only when consumers have said they're willing to pay for the cost of that advanced meter. Unless it's a new build or it's inconsistent with the depreciation cycle of the meters.
Speak up, please.
Sorry. In this scenario where meters are going to be deployed only where consumers actually have agreed to bear the cost of that advanced meter, the system supporting those meters needs to be, the cost of putting in the system to read those meters needs to be borne by additional applications beyond those that are simply derived from the meter program itself or demand response programs. And indeed, that's what a smart grid is. I think someone this morning referred to it as an energy intranet. It's going to enable all of the applications to enable us as end users, but also the utility companies, to provide for efficiencies. For instance, reducing line losses, reducing the energy needed even before consumers change their behavior. What a utility can do is reduce the amount of electricity it needs to distribute down the wires and purchase from generators by optimizing the way the grid works to minimize losses or to optimize the level of voltage that actually flows down the wires so there's no more voltage distributed than we actually need to support that level of demand.
You have 30 seconds.
Thank you. Importantly, a smart grid can largely, if not entirely, achieve the targeted consumption reduction goals of Act 129 without requiring any consumer behavior change whatsoever with respect to demand response and other applications which are sure to follow. Finally, I'll just mention the Energy Independence and Security Act passed last year by Congress actually requires each of the states to evaluate smart grid programs starting next month, December of this year, and completing those studies by December of 2009. So I think that the Act 129 proceedings present the Commission with an opportunity to address those federal Act obligations. Thank you.
Next, we have Mr.
Chisty
of Commerce.
Thank you. I'd like to thank the Commission for inviting me to speak here today. I'm Bob Chisty, Chief Executive Officer of Converge, Inc. Converge has been a public company since 2007 and currently has 350 employees. Each and every one of those employees focus on only one business, and that is demand management for the electric industry. We believe we're the largest curtailment service provider, although we haven't called ourselves a curtailment service provider until this act, in North America, focusing on all customer classes, residential, commercial, and industrial. One of our three major offices is in the thriving metropolis of Kennett Square, which Mr. Paulson knows well. We have about 15% of our employees are employed in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. I want to commend the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania on Act 129, which I believe is the most holistic approach to energy conservation in the country. As was mentioned by Commissioner Hanger this morning, it is now all about execution. Converge currently operates in almost every state in the Union, manages over 800 megawatts of residential demand management, over 1,400 megawatts of commercial and industrial, and in fact has a products arm where we've sold almost 5 million devices, or about 6,000 megawatts of devices, which are deployed across the country, as you could see in this map. To that end, I only want to assure this commission that the technology is here. That is not the issue. Demand programs operate either as part of or independent of smart metering systems. And Converge has deployed the outsourced pay-for-performance business model now in 8 states. Also, we have 500 utility customers. As PICO remarked this morning, we concur that curtailment service providers be defined broadly to include those that are allowed to provide marketing services, measurement and verification services, operations, maintenance, but most importantly, pay-for-performance operations. This is the model that Converge has built itself on, whereby we provide services to the utility or to the ISO on a pay-for-performance basis, using our capital, our installation teams, our marketing teams to secure that customer base. Could you turn to slide 9? Just very quickly, I would like to point to one of our favorite slides in the company. if we could get to it. Slide 9. If you look at the bottom right hand of this slide, this is actually a demand management system actually being performed at Rocky Mountain Power in Salt Lake City. We've signed up about 100,000 homes and small businesses. You could see that their system was operating. The blue line is actually their load curve. At about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the heat came up as people came home and turned on their central air conditioners. With our system in place, we dropped about 100 megawatts of load within a 2-minute period. So we stayed in that cycling period, controlling central air conditioners for about 3 hours. You could see how the peak would have otherwise occurred. That peak would have required significant costs for wholesale power or another power plant, which Rocky Mountain Power was able to avoid. In the top left, you probably can't see that very well, but this is the penetration. We have about 30-40% penetration on residential and small businesses in any given utility, and we could bring those on in a period of about 3 years. So with that said, I'll cede the rest of my time for questions and answers later.
Thank you. Next, we have Ms. Pegendor of Clear Choice Energy.
Yes, Carolyn Pegendor. Good afternoon. We are a privately owned Pittsburgh-based company providing energy management, specifically energy procurement services.
Pull the mic closer and speak up, please?
Sure. We are also a curtailment service provider in the PJM, offering the PJM programs to the customers, and we're targeting school districts and also municipalities. My comments go to the issues around the definition of the conservation service provider, as well as the qualifications. And throughout this morning, I guess in early afternoon, I have had concerns about the impact that programs here may have on the competitive market. I had expressed those concerns as House Bill 2200 was going through the legislature, and was pleased to see that they did provide a definition in the act that excluded the utilities and their affiliates from providing those services. However, what I now understand is that the utilities may still be able to use the ratepayer-funded brand name to provide services, but simply outsource it to perhaps large
providers.
Could you pull
the microphone a little bit closer, please?
Sure. Under this act, we are currently in the market, and our experience today in selling demand response services, specifically to school districts right now, is that we are finding that EDC-offered programs are significantly below the competitive market here in this Pennsylvania. We've had the experience of selling this to a local school district. We had 7 meetings with school district officials. We've been educating them. We got their historical usage data. We did extensive load analysis on that data, found a problem in a mechanical system that was costing them an additional 17% on their bill, which we resolved for them. We brought licensed electricians out to the schools with data loggers at our expense to measure the effect of various curtailment measures on the schools and to quantify and assure their performance in the PJM program. Despite all of this, as we got ready for a school board meeting to talk with the school board about the contracting process, one of the school district officials said, well, we need to get some other quotes. And what we found out was that our prices were about the same, or in some cases less than the competitive providers, but they were able to call the EDC, which had none of the sales or marketing expenses that we had, did none of the work that we did, and got a price significantly below ours. I did speak to the representative from that EDC and asked them about their point of differentiation from other curtailment service providers in the market, and he said simply, our prices are lower. And if I could be simply an order taker, as opposed to out there doing the work that I'm doing with customer education, sales, and marketing, I could perhaps be much lower too. So my concern has to do with the effect of having the EDCs use their brand names to compete in this marketplace. And I believe that it's very similar and analogous to what has happened in the retail power supply business with the electric generators. In Pennsylvania, as well as other states with retail deregulation, customers move away from utility supply and choose competitive supply options when utility rates are higher than competitive rates, but at times when utility rates are lower than the current competitive rates, as they are within the EDC service territories in the Commonwealth, where generation supply is still under rate caps, very little to no competitive options exist. We would like to see competition thrive. We believe that robust competition will drive innovation and will educate the customers. You only need to look to the Penn Power Service territory when it opened to understand the rapid pace at which competitive providers will educate customers on savings opportunities. The rate caps in the Penn Power Service territory expired on January 1st of 2007, and within 6 months, 44% of the customer load had moved to alternative suppliers. If left to market forces over the next 2 years, rising electric rates from the expiration of rate caps, coupled with savings opportunities from energy efficiency and demand response programs in what will be the fourth largest competitive electric market in the U.S. will drive extensive competition and product innovation within the Commonwealth's retail electric market.
You have 30 seconds.
Okay. We, in our paper, and I know I don't have time to go through this right now, but we are proposing a market structure for demand response specifically that is an open market program, much like the PJM program, where the EDCs would add a financial incentive onto the PJM payment. This was done over the last 3 years in PJM's program, and it worked. It worked significantly, very, very well. It uses the same data, the same meter data for settlements that they've used in the past. It's easy. The EDCs have done it before, and the PJM experience demonstrates that it works extremely effectively. And so we are recommending an open market program for demand response as opposed to bilateral contracting as an outsourced provider to the EDCs. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we will have Mr. Rettigliano for the Mid-Atlantic Region, C-Power, Inc.
Okay. Commissioners, good afternoon. Okay. Commissioners, good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I represent C-Power, a curtailment service provider that provides demand response and other demand-side management services in every organized market in North America. I'd like to take this opportunity to emphasize the role independent curtailment service providers can provide in meeting Act 129's goals, which we believe they can do at the lowest possible cost to ratepayers, especially when compared to EDC programs. We believe that provision of demand-side management is inherently a competitive activity, and that any organization able to provide demand-side services should be allowed to do so on roughly equal terms with the EDCs. Specifically, when independent CSPs can deliver verified energy savings at a lower price than EDC programs, they should be allowed to do so. As previous speakers have emphasized, there are many ways that a competitive market benefits ratepayers. In particular, we see that because CSPs have no recourse to rate recovery, ratepayers bear none of the risk of CSP program performance. The previous two speakers also emphasized that CSPs bring their own capital and undergo these programs at their own expense and risk. As smaller companies, CSPs may have more flexibility than regulated utilities to develop particular opportunities. We see certain CSPs that seek to compete through superior customer service or specialization in particular market segments, both of which we feel bring benefits to ratepayers. And finally, because CSPs are not generally providers of retail electricity, there is no possibility of conflict of interest between different segments of the same business. In our written testimony, we provided one suggestion for how a truly competitive energy efficiency market might function. We modeled our suggestions after successful renewable portfolio standards. I'm sure time won't allow me to go into details on that, but I'd like to emphasize two points that we feel are particularly important in creating a competitive market. First, we respectfully suggest that EDCs be allowed to meet their Act 129 responsibilities through the purchase of energy efficiency credits that represent verified savings from energy efficiency projects, which could be sponsored by EDCs, could be sponsored by CSPs. This is similar to the White Certificates program currently active in Pennsylvania. And second, we suggest that EDCs only be allowed rate recovery for the results of their demand response activities and not for the activities themselves. That is to say, we would find a rate recovery plan based on a price per kilowatt hour preferable to one that was based on program costs. Okay, switching topics briefly, let me briefly mention possible synergies with PJM's energy efficiency market. PJM has stated that they intend to allow energy efficiency to bid their capacity market in the near future. In the demand-side management industry, we find that every dollar really does matter, and often projects only make sense when they capture every possible revenue stream. We respectfully request that the Commission examine the possibilities for harmonizing Act 129 programs with PJM's wholesale market, and in particular, we find it extremely helpful if a single set of M&V standards applied to both, eliminating the need for redundant measurement and verification. Finally, let me move on to the peak reduction portion of Act 129. At CPower, what we found most striking about those requirements was that they could really be met in a very straightforward manner by packaging products already available on PJM's wholesale market. I realize that not everyone in the Commission is a wholehearted fan of PJM's markets, but I think they have taken a leadership role in developing demand response, and I think there's general agreement they've been fairly successful at that. We respectfully request that the Commission consider the extent to which EDCs can meet their Act 129 peak load reduction requirements through purchases on PJM's wholesale demand response market, and that the Commission take care that any EDC peak management programs not amount to ratepayer subsidized competition in what has been a vigorous competitive demand response market. Finally, in conclusion, we'd just like to say that CPower is a believer in controlled electricity deregulation and in the benefits that wholesale competition and retail choice provide to ratepayers. Looking at the demand side marketplace, we see very much the same benefits from competition and urge the Commission to consider implementing Act 129 in a manner that does not unduly privilege EDCs, creates a level playing field for all who seek to provide energy efficiency services, and ensures that ratepayers pay the lowest possible price from meeting the Act 129 commitments. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we will have Mr. Gray on behalf of Elster Integrated Solutions.
Good afternoon. I'm Ed Gray from EIS. Elster is one of the world's largest metering companies. We have 7,500 employees, for example. I'd like to go to slide 6, please. One of the things we really haven't talked much about, I don't think, as yet, is you need price and technology together to get a lot of demand response. These are Brattle Group numbers, and as you can see, going from the time of use rates, which aren't very effective among those in Maryland where I live, down to CPP with enabled technology, you get a tremendous leverage in how much demand response you get. Next slide, please. We had a large seminar at BWI Airport earlier this year, and we voted early and often, and one of the questions we had was this one: what's the most effective means for administering DR and PJM? And the experts that were there voted like this. AMI with technology that automates DR was the highest rated. Second was more CSP work with commercial industrial markets. And you see smart meters only with pricing to drive DR got a lower number of votes. And the lowest of all was more residential DLC. One of the things we talked about was should we have metering rules or not? I certainly think we should. And I think a good example is Maryland, if we go to slide 13. Maryland addressed a number of issues, and they did it in just a few pages. If you look at bullet number 2, and this is only a summary of it, it's actually a little bit longer. It talks about non-discriminatory access for retail electric suppliers and curtailment service providers to meter data. We've talked about that. The next to last one on this page talks about the meter data management basically staying in the utility. I think a reason for that, and some of your questions get to that question, is what's the control of this data? What degree do we have the confidence that it won't be abused or whatever? So that's one approach to that solution. 15, please. There was some discussion about smart grid. I guess our perspective is it's the part of the smart grid that works already. We have a number of standards, American national standards. These apply in the U.S. and Canada for how things talk to each other. We have a number of standards as well that some ad hoc groups, such as the Zigbee Alliance, have put together. Basically, on an RFP today, typically from a utility for a smart metering system, we're required to offer them Zigbee-implemented demand response pretty typically. So that's, of course, what we do. So that helps us operate with a home area network. The other thing is, of course, that's important is backwards compatibility. In the case of Elster, we're using our version 6 automation software all the way back to our 2003 meters. For the future, we have future-proofing things such as over-the-air firmware upgrades. As indicated by a previous speaker, the smart grid is in a number of recent acts in the last year from Congress. One was the EISA, which talks about the smart grid from a policy standpoint, but doesn't provide any money to do anything about it. Although my understanding is the incoming Democratic administration does intend to fund these activities in that act. The next one had both funds and some other things in it, including reducing the lifetime of AMI and distribution automation to 10 years for tax life. So that will help reduce the cost up front. And then we have the ESA of 2008, which unfortunately has a very short-term benefit as it stands now. We're trying to get it extended. I don't know if we'll be able to do that. This has a 50% first-year bonus depreciation on top of that shorter tax life. So if you look at the time value of money, if you could take ESA and EESA and put those together, and there's some customers of ours that are tend to do that, they could get quite a significant reduction in the cash flow needs for the first few years. And that's typically where AMI and smart grid projects have a problem, is what does it cost in the first few years to non-participants? I think people have indicated that. Typically, these systems do pay off for non-participants after the first couple of years, but getting through the first couple of years is what the difficulty is. So anyway, that's what I had to say. I look forward to questions later. Thank you.
Next, we have Mr. Garland from Clear Result Consulting.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, fellow commissioners. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Clear Result, I guess under the definition here, would be a conservation service provider. We design and implement energy efficiency programs that utilities offer to their customers. We're working with quite a number of utilities throughout the country, and we've also got quite a bit of experience in working in deregulated markets like Texas, where we do face the issue of the transmission and distribution company versus the retail electric provider, and how do you handle those conflicts. And I'm sure, in essence of time, you're aware of what's going on nationally, that quite a number of states are expanding their energy efficiency portfolios. We've probably seen the industry rise by more than $1 billion in annual spend over the last couple of years. As such, firms like ourselves and other firms are out there in the marketplace, and even as the demand is growing, it's still a highly competitive market. There are a number of qualified firms that are out there that can provide services for the EDC. We do feel that the EDCs are in the best position through their unique knowledge of their customer and their customer base and the history of working with them to put the customer-focused programs in the market. We also feel pretty strongly that the firms such as ours and others can provide the third-party implementation of those programs on behalf of the EDCs by bringing specialized expertise, national knowledge, lessons learned from other states, and knowledge of what's working and what's not working. As Commissioner Gardner pointed out earlier, we also accept the risk of performance. In almost every contract we have, we're paid on our performance, so we're used to that, and we embrace it, actually. we do feel that bringing the lessons learned, there are a lot of lessons learned as a number of states have launched programs. One thing that bears out, if you're going on vacation, you can't wait till all the lights are green to go. Sometimes you just have to charge ahead. A number of states have instituted quick start programs in order to kickstart energy efficiency program delivery by focusing on some of the most attractive programs that are working on a national basis, finding the ones that are applicable for your jurisdiction and implementing those programs and then taking the lessons learned. It gets you further down the road faster. I would certainly encourage that, and you're able to incorporate the feedback. Instead of having to get all of the rules right from the start, you can get most of them, take the feedback, reconvene with a collaborative, and have ultimately more effective programs based on what's worked. And these pilot programs can certainly evolve. We've seen a lot of experience across the country, especially in the commercial and industrial markets, where there have been customer segment focus. As a colleague down to the right mentioned, programs that are focused on schools or hospitals or commercial office buildings or retail. The motivations for each commercial customer are based on the unique value propositions of running their unique businesses. And so programs that are designed to hit these businesses with what appeals to them make a lot more sense. Certainly in the residential sector, I agree with my colleague Mr. Thomas that really focusing on the whole house perspective and getting deeper with more meaningful energy efficiency in each house is a much better approach than kind of skimming across the surface. I'd also say you can't fatten a pig by weighing it. Having a lot of information isn't necessarily helpful at times when you have 30-year-old equipment that's operating a system. A lot of times that actually the equipment needs to be replaced, insulation needs to be added, there need to be concrete things done to the facilities in order to make them more energy efficient. Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have Mr. Kirsch of Positive Energy, Inc.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, esteemed commissioners, thank you for having me here today. I thank the commission for the opportunity to present today. My name is Jeremy Kirsch, Vice President of Client Solutions for Positive Energy, a privately held company who is now working with several utilities around the country to help solve some of the problems that we've discussed already this morning. My hope is to inform the interested parties here today that existing information and normative analyses are becoming key assets in energy efficiency portfolios of leading utilities across the U.S. and how they can be leveraged here in the Commonwealth. By giving customers information about their energy consumption and how this consumption compares with people like them and households like theirs, utilities are finally able to help customers understand how efficient their lifestyle is and what they specifically can do to become more efficient. As a result of these analyses, recommendations for behavioral and more structural changes can be targeted specifically to customers in a very effective way. The resource being leveraged here is not more equipment, but the resource being leveraged in this case is the information itself. And this is not future information, this is current information. So both today and into an AMI-enabled future, this information is the valuable energy efficiency asset. In the next few minutes, I'm going to discuss why that is and how it's been working around the country. Slide 4, please. There's about 15 years of behavioral science research behind what I'm about to discuss. This is a study that was done outside of San Diego in San Marcos in 2003. And we've talked a lot about educating customers and motivating them. We discussed it this morning. This study was done by Dr. Bob Cialdini and his group. And Bob is actually leading a workshop next week for the New York Public Service Commission as they engage their 15 by 15 program. to talk about these exact issues. We did a study on a few thousand homes, read meters. We had a lot of grad students get caffeinated and go around and read these meters. And then we delivered one of four messages to these homes. The first message was, did you know you could save $40 a month if you just turned off your air conditioner and turned on your fan during the peak evening hours? The second group got an environmental message. Be a green Californian. Turn off your air conditioner and turn on your fan during the peak evening hours. The third group got a good citizen message. This was during 2003 when there were rolling blackouts. Be a good Californian, help prevent rolling blackouts. Turn off your air conditioner and turn on your fan. We then went out and read meters again for 6 weeks after we had delivered one door hanger. This was just one message delivered to the homes. And there was a zero impact on consumption. It was as if we hadn't even gotten caffeinated and we hadn't even gone out, read the meters, and had not given the messages. However, the fourth group received a message that was normative. We told folks that, did you know that 75% of their neighbors, when surveyed, turn off their air conditioner and turn on their fans during the peak evening hours? We saw a 6% reduction in consumption for 6 weeks. 6 weeks from one door hanger. Next slide, please. So it turns out that even though our mothers told us that what the Joneses are doing isn't important, it actually is quite important. We've got a very strong social norm here at work. When people are surveyed, over 90%, it doesn't matter where in the country it's done, over 90% of people say that they try to conserve, they try to be energy efficient. But most of them don't know what that means. When you ask them a second-order question such as, are you efficient? What can you do to become more efficient? They actually can't answer those questions. I think what we've heard this morning is that the utilities who testified and the commission and the other stakeholders here cannot do this alone.
You have 30 seconds.
So how do we engage millions of customers? You have to do it using a multi-channel approach, and we do it starting in the mail. These are home energy reports that are delivered to now hundreds of thousands of consumers across the country that lets them know how they're doing relative to people like them. And I'll just skip to slide seven. We've been doing this work with several utilities. This is a program being done out in Sacramento, 35,000 homes. For the last 6 months, we've been measuring a 2% reduction in consumption. This equates to about 9,000 megawatt hours of savings sustained over 6 months from delivering the mail. We haven't put a meter in anybody's home. We've just given people information about how they're doing relative to others. So I thank you for this time this afternoon, and we look forward to working here in the Commonwealth with the utilities on these types of programs.
Thank you. Next we have Ms. Perrine from Affordable Comfort, Inc.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you. Thank you for opening up dialogue on these important issues. I am speaking on behalf of 65 member groups called the Keystone Energy Efficiency Alliance. They are people who reside in Pennsylvania and have energy efficiency expertise and have worked in energy efficiency programs here and in many other states. There is a depth of energy efficiency expertise already existing and is growing in the state of Pennsylvania. Many of these are small groups, and many of these groups have hands-on experience with delivering energy efficiency in the residential sector, which is one of the most difficult sectors to deliver energy efficiency in because of the scale. Pennsylvania is unique in that our housing stock is, on average, 70 years old. Much of the housing is older than that. There is a significant need for us to improve the housing stock that we have and to ensure that the new houses that are built to an aggressive energy efficiency standard. For that, we recommend that you take a look at and seriously consider a statewide implementation of the Home Performance with Energy Star program and the Energy Star Qualified Homes program. Energy Star says that their goal is 20% above code. Many times today, a new home buyer will be told that a new home meets code. The sad fact is that a code-built home is a minimal standard and is not anywhere near as efficient as it should be. Quite often today, we are building new homes that could be energy retrofitted just as soon as they're occupied. They are not meeting the quality that our families deserve in Pennsylvania. We recommend that by using the Energy Star portfolio of programs for the residential sector, that people who are working on homes attain some standards met by the Building Performance Institute and the ResNet for new homes. Guaranteeing that contractors and builders who work on homes are working to a higher standard than just meeting code. This is an important element in addressing our goals for energy efficiency and meeting the goals of this act. We need to establish policy, which we're doing with this act. We need to also provide the right incentives, both for the utility companies as well as for the consumers and the service providers, the contractors who would embrace new work habits. And we need to prepare the customers with education and awareness. If we adopt a standard kind of program, there will be less confusion and more market uptake of the programs. If utilities offer programs that differ from one service territory to the other, you will be not getting the scale of the programs, and you will be introducing market confusion. So we recommend that you take a statewide approach. Right now, there is a study underway by ACEEE that has been commissioned by DEP in Pennsylvania to take a look at the energy efficiency potential in Pennsylvania specifically. ACEEE has a variety of studies that they've done for other states, and we are looking for that study for Pennsylvania to be completed by Thanksgiving in just another week, where we're anticipating that that will give us a great deal of guidance on what kinds of programs and measures should be undertaken in Pennsylvania that will give us the best quality and the best results for energy efficiency.
You have 30 seconds.
I would like to say that we can and we are installing energy efficient equipment and appliances as retrofits. And we are installing energy-efficient equipment in new homes. That doesn't equate to an efficient home. And it is with the whole house approach to looking at the house or the building that you can guarantee the performance of that building and assure that it's working up to its potential. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Mr. Bloom from Real Win-Win, Inc.
I want to thank the commission for permitting me to speak today. Real and Wind is a Philadelphia-based, it would be a conservation service provider under the definition herein. And what we do is we bridge the gap between utilities and corporate America with respect to energy efficiency utility incentive programs. We do it in a couple ways. We work with the energy departments, the facilities departments, the construction departments of national retail chains. Those chains own and operate more than a billion square feet nationwide. And we file thousands of applications in hundreds of utility programs nationwide. We also are contracted by utilities for segment-specific approaches in different regions to actually drive gigawatt hours off the grid. So that gives us a special point of view with respect to utility incentive programs. I had all these insightful ideas I was going to share with you, but they've already been more or less stated, so I'm going to reemphasize the ones that I think are most important. I think we have a $600 million opportunity here, and probably more when you think about all the other monies that's going to funnel in. We should really make sure that we take full advantage of the opportunity the money provides. We should create programs which are segment-specific. For example, commercial real estate is, by ACEEE, is estimated at wasting 20% of every dollar spent on energy. Yet they are reluctant to make change. Why? Because of the lease mechanics of commercial real estate. National retail chains are committed to energy efficiency, have a very poor opinion on utility incentive programs because of the bureaucracy utilities impose. We should create programs with your whole building approach. It cannot be overemphasized. If you're going to touch a building, touch it for everything. Don't just look at one specific measure. Don't change the lights and forget about the rooftop units on the top of the building. Rebates versus incentives. There's a whole concern about free ridership. Free ridership is bunk. Utilities should be able to publish and the commission should be able to say, here's what a good job looks like. Go do it. We'll reward you for that. We'll help you reduce the first cost. And I'm willing to talk with everybody about free ridership and free drivership at some point. We need to incent smart buildings. That means meters, sub-meters, EMS, BAS. It means load shedding technology. And most of all, it means continuous monitoring. Because there's a lot of commissioning programs out there throughout the country, but commissioning has a half-life. And unless you continuously monitor a building, I don't care if it's a residence, I don't care if it's a large office building, a million square feet, continuous monitoring drives 5 to 15% of energy out of the building just because people are aware of what the heck's going on in that building. And finally, I think don't forget segment-specific education. Even if you have specific prescriptive-type rebate programs, whether they be custom or prescriptive, and they're not segment-specific, segment-specific monies paid at education and marketing will drive projects into your incentive programs and will drive energy conservation measures into the community, and it will drive energy off the grid. So you need to look at educating the market, segment-specific, drive to those issues that are keeping that segment from participating today. And I think lastly, as I said, there's an incredible opportunity here. I'm very, very nervous that the commission says to the utilities, go out and create utility programs. Come tell us what the best ideas are. I think the best ideas are already out there. The approach the commission should be relatively heavy-handed, saying, go and find out what the best ideas are. Come back. Take PA state approaches to the measures and approaches and the systems and the bureaucracy and the systems people have to do to apply for these programs, how they're going to be delivered. And then the payouts will be different by based upon what the actual cost of energy is in those regions. But let the commission drive. Here's what a good job looks like. And then let the utilities have to comply, because the bureaucracy gets to be nuts when the utilities all create different ways of approaching. You can't file on Tuesday, this one files on Friday, this one has a January cutoff, this one has a March cutoff. We need to have continuity. You want to be these simple, clear, important ways of getting access to energy conservation. I probably wrote down more stuff here. I can't really read it right now, and I'm a little nervous. So I'm just going to say I really appreciate questions. I'd love to be engaged more further down the line if you need me. Thank you.
Thank you. Finally, we have Mr. Payne from CMC Energy Services.
Always hate being the last thing between the break and questions. CMC Energy has been around for 30 years. We conduct energy efficiency programs for utilities. We've conducted about 300,000 residential audits, about 30,000 small commercial audits, currently doing programs for PECO as well as PSE&G. We also are probably the only company that has a national network of independent energy efficiency auditors. We're in 46 states, 700 people are using our proprietary software to conduct energy efficiency audits. I love public hearings. I love public hearings because in public hearings, you get debate. You get different points of view and different information. And part of my point in my remaining 4 minutes is to agree with what four people have said, but then dispute passionately the other half of what they said. Point one, everybody here says that residential energy audits, whole house approach, are key and probably fundamental. That's the baseline in terms of being able to take advantage of this huge opportunity in the residential energy efficiency segment. So to Preen's point, probably in Pennsylvania, 80% of the opportunity for energy efficiency is in existing housing stock using whole house retrofit approaches. The point where the dog doesn't hunt anymore, though, for me, when it comes to what they're talking about, though, is home performance with Energy Star. I was in my testimony, I had a phrase in there that said, beware of market transformation programs. Well, guess what? That's exactly what home performance with Energy Star is. The reasons? It takes too long to develop. It takes too much money. It can't achieve scale. There's lots of learning, if you look around the country, that will point that out. And I'm just going to point across the river for a case in point. New Jersey's Clean Energy Program, Home Performance for Energy Star, has been there 4 years. 2 years to ramp it up, 2 years of marketing. To date, and I'm on a committee that actually reviews this on a monthly basis, this is public information, $15 million has been spent. $15 million in 4 years to ramp, build, and market this program. And to date, as of September the 30th, 450 residential audits had been completed. 4 years, $15 million, 450 audits. Of the 450 audits, 80 houses actually had retrofit measures installed. I'm not an economist, I'm not a mathematician, but $15 million to do 450 audits just doesn't pass my a hee-haw test for me. So, I gave you the good news, I gave you the bad news, now what can you do? There are a couple of things you can do, and it's simply, to Doug's point, look at learning, look at what's happened in the marketplace, look at the real-world experience. A couple of things. Provide guidelines for program development that reflect what consumers really want when it comes to a home audit. They want to have the option for an independent audit. They don't want a contractor to do it. They don't want the chickens in the hen house. If a contractor does the inspection, a consumer doesn't want them to bid and then do the work. Point two, have a price point that's reasonable for consumers. Most of these audits with home performance are in the $400 to $500 range because they include very, very expensive diagnostic equipment and double the time. Consumers want a price point in the $200 to $250 range. These things cost $500. That program is not going to work. Finally, the consumer wants a piece of information that they can act on that's simple and easy to read. They want a report that tells them in dollars and cents how to save money and where to save it. Their reports typically talk about thermal units or kilowatt hours. They provide measures and analysis in terms that consumers don't understand. Finally, you know, they talked about standards and qualifications. To get a BPI and resident certification to be in their program, back of the envelope, it's about $20,000. When you buy the infrared camera, you get a blower door test, you miss 2 weeks of work, you pay thousands of dollars for training, hundreds of dollars for getting passed, and then in effect union dues because you have to re-up every year. It's a $20,000 nut. And the experience, the real-world experience, is that that certification process becomes a barrier to entry. It's a competitive barrier based on price that permits the small independent inspector, the small contractor, from participating in these programs. So what can you do? To recap, I would make energy efficiency audits a mandate, whole house audits a mandate, before people take advantage of other components in the program. If you're going to put in a new HVAC system and get a subsidy, if you're going to put in a smart meter, if you're going to put in a solar panel on your house, you ought to get the house fixed first. You ought to have an audit, a residential energy audit, to get the house optimized before you spend other ratepayer money. Two, as I mentioned before, learn from the marketplace. Look at consumers, respond to their needs and their lack of response and interest in home performance in other states. And then finally, in terms of standards, set this up so that it's inclusive. The opportunity here is huge. The need for technicians is tremendous. Already in New Jersey, we're seeing a lack of insulation contractors and people can do home fitting. You don't want to block the small contractor out of the market. So again, go whole house, use learning, and make sure you leave the market open to competitive service. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. We'll now turn to questions. Vice Chairman Christie.
Okay. Thank you. First off, in general terms, I'd like to thank all of you for being here today.
You've given us a lot of ideas, a lot of thoughts, a lot of opportunities for us to save energy in Pennsylvania. But you've probably made our job more difficult, because now how do we figure out what of all these different technologies and programs should we adopt? So we really do have a challenge here on trying to figure out which is the best way to move forward. Cliff, I'll just join in and thank you for your comments, because I think my main theme on all of this is that we need to keep it simple, and we need to pick the low-hanging fruit, and we need to move forward with those programs and technologies that we know will work and save money. Now, that doesn't mean we ignore the longer term and look for the future type of smart grid type of programs. But as a very simple example, I outfitted my home with compact fluorescent light bulbs. I spent $90, and I've been saving $15 to $20 a month. Very simple technology, 15 to 20%. And we have a standard that we have to reduce our peak demand by 4.5% in the year 2013. Well, if everyone just did compact fluorescent light bulbs, we're there. So I think we need to balance the smart grid, more challenging technologies with some common sense, low-hanging fruit. A couple of just quick questions. Arthur, you mentioned about some residential combined heat and power. I've been a big fan of the industrial and the commercial combined heat and power plants. On the residential side, do you really think that's economically feasible at this time?
Yes, there are systems currently available that are provide reasonable economic paybacks. There's a system currently available now that has been used, has been in the market in Massachusetts for a while, that is now going nationwide, and they have a payback of the incremental cost compared to a high efficiency furnace or boiler of roughly 6 or 7 years.
Maybe offline I could talk to you and get more information on that program. My next question is for Greg from the PA Home Services. I really like that program where you have the certified auditors performing the audits. The one challenge I saw in the program, however, was once you identify the saving opportunities, it's getting people to actually do the programs. And maybe you can comment on funding needs that you would see that would be needed in order to make those audits actually, at the end of the day, bear fruit for people.
Right. Excuse me. There are two aspects to this. One is a coordination with loan programs is critical. So there's a relationship between PA Home Energy and Keystone Help to help the homeowner overcome the first costs. So one of the most cost-effective ways to do that is to subsidize the interest rates associated with that. So you're not affecting the market price point, but you're making it easier for people to overcome first costs. Secondly, a number of the in PA Home Energy, we have a mix of contractors and consultants. We support sort of both models. The energy audit model, where someone goes out and hires someone as a third party, but also the direct delivery model, where someone under the context of a quality assurance process can offer both the energy audit and the installation services. And so that there's a direct, and this is one of the lessons learned from EPA, is that having the service providers operating within a quality assurance context, certified people, their work is being checked, gives the most motivation to convert that energy audit into an installation. And that's been learned in a number of markets across the country.
I had a question for Jay from Concurrent. Very promising technology with some significant benefits to consumers at the end of the day. How do we go about evaluating that type of technology right now with the type of program that we might be moving forward on the DSM side, implementing our House Bill 2200? I mean, how do you sell this to the utility, and how do you sell this to us We only have so much money to spend here on our programs, and it seems like what you have makes a lot of sense, but it looks like a rather sizable program.
It can be, but it does not have to be, Mr. Vice Chairman. For instance, if you take an average substation, I think it's around 5,000 homes in this country, which means about 1,000, I'm bad at math, but assume 5 homes per transformer, they have about 1,000 transformers for a substation area. A very small percentage, very low single-digit percentage of those transformers is where we would actually go put equipment to get you into a smart grid right away. It would produce significant returns to the utility. It would pay for itself in 3 to 4 years. It would not necessarily read the meters and do all the demand response applications you wanted, but in a state like Pennsylvania, where the law says you only put up the meters and presumably the supporting network to read those meters when customers sign up for the program, that actually is the sort of perfect way to go deploy a smart meter system that is only pay for it as you go as consumers need it. So one of the cost inherent in a smart meter system often stems from the fact that when we build out meters, we think we need to do it ubiquitously, at least outside of Pennsylvania until you had the new Act 129. Most utility programs propose to build out all of the meters in a relatively short period of time, 2, 3, 4 years. And that's where the large cost comes from. Not all consumers can benefit from that. I think 40% of the consumers in the United States do not have central air conditioning. So without central air conditioning, you question how valuable would, say, programmable thermostats be. So what we're really doing with the smart grid is putting the money to use where the utility can get the biggest return early on. You mentioned the low-hanging fruit. I would submit that the lowest hanging fruit is the electricity that is lost before it ever gets to our homes and businesses. Things that the utility company today could fix relatively inexpensively, but either has no regulatory incentive to fix or until recently didn't really have the technology available to it.
Thank you. I had a question for Clear Choice, Carolyn.
Yes.
It's good to see a fellow Western Pennsylvania person here. I found your presentation very interesting. A couple of simple questions. With respect to Penn Power, and I'm a Penn Power customer, and I shop. I simply pick up the phone and I call an alternative supplier, and you save 10% just by picking up the phone. But on the residential side, we just can't seem to get people to do that. And I don't know if you have any suggestions on how we can get people to open up and pick up the phone and take advantage of the saving opportunities.
Yes, what I would suggest is looking to the Texas market. When Texas opened its market, they specifically did it in a way, I think as Richie Hudson had mentioned earlier, that utility rates, which were known as the price to beat, were set at a price that was higher than the competitive market price. And that was done to incentivize competition to occur in the state. And competition has flourished, and it has not only flourished in the commercial and industrial segment, and it's also flourished in the residential segment. And so there are many retailers in the Texas market providing energy supply that have some pretty innovative programs around marketing and how they get out to the residential customer that I think would be very effective in this situation as well.
That's I might disagree with that approach.
Okay.
It just seems when the people don't want to shop, and if you set the price higher,
right,
then they still might not shop. Maybe there's easier ways that we can get the message out for them to save the money.
Mm-hmm.
But I know what you're saying. If you set the price high enough, then that will encourage a lot of people to maybe pick up the phone. But people have been lazy, quite frankly, and that's what concerns me. Your comments on FERC Order 719 I thought was very, very good, and I think represents a big opportunity for us in the state. Can you talk to us a little bit about the opportunity here and the challenges and the timing of when this might all come into play? Because I think this aggregation is very important, and I think represents a great way for the smaller customers to participate in the PJM programs.
Yes. The timeline, I'm not sure what the timeline is for all of the programs in FERC Order 719. And for those who aren't familiar with that particular order, what it's trying to do is get to integrate the demand side or the customer side into the wholesale supply market, and in a way that's comparable to power generators. So essentially, anything that a power generator would get paid for today, those same payments would extend to the demand side or the customer side resource. PJM has made an excellent start on that program through its offerings to integrate demand side resources into their capacity market. They're doing it into the real-time and the day-ahead market through their economic program, and starting in 2009, they will be treating energy efficiency as a capacity resource, and so energy efficiency projects will receive an additional payment, or could receive an additional payment if they're bid into the PJM capacity market auction. But FERC Order 719 extends that program to ancillary services. So if you can respond on, say, a 10-minute notice, or if you can respond on a 1-minute notice, there are various other payments that can become available to those demand-side resources. There are two infrastructure issues that I see today that are impediments to doing this. First is the need for historical usage information. That is a challenge to get customers to sign up today. And the procedures across the Commonwealth vary. In some service territories, we simply get the customer to sign our letter of authorization, we send it in, and we get the data within 1 day. Other service territories, they make us put the information, or actually have the customer put it onto their own letterhead, get the customer to sign it, and the customer cannot email it or fax it in. They actually have to put it in the U.S. mail. Once it gets there, it can be a month, or frankly, I'm not sure how long it's going to take, because we're still waiting to try to get this data. So getting historical usage and other relevant information from the EDC at no additional cost in a timely manner is a key to overcoming the obstacle to implementing demand response, as well as key to getting competitive procurement to occur in your service territories. The other impediment today has to do with the utility meters. There's been great discussion about the need for the smart meters. And what we are seeing in the schools, we are seeing this in the government entities, the smaller commercial entities, is that they do not have the interval meters that are necessary to participate in the programs that PJM offers. And so we have to switch out metering equipment. We have to get real-time load monitoring to occur, and that involves an equipment switch that costs time and money. So to facilitate the expansion of the programs that are being contemplated under FERC Order 719, as well as what PJM is already offering today, it would be great if some of the funding that's available would be put forth to underwrite the cost of metering and other equipment that would be necessary to enable those programs.
Thank you. You mentioned a project with a school district in western Pennsylvania. What school district was that?
That's Upper St. Clair.
Okay. That's good. My brother's involved with one school district, and if he was roughing you up, I'd want to know about it. And he scrubs the numbers more than I do, so I could feel for you there. That's all I had. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Commissioner Pallison.
Thank you. I want to thank this panel. First of all, you guys worked up, did a great job. And I am struggling right now with this old paradigm of cost recovery versus what I see from the CSP community, which is really where we need to be, is pay per performance. And I want to take and thank my folk from Converge, giving great kudos to the thriving metropolis of Kennett Square, Pennsylvania. But in your one of your slides, I refer to slide 9, does Act 129 require the utility to competitively bid all energy efficiency efficiency and conservation services. And you alluded to the fact, you say yes, but for the exception that the EDC may define. And if anybody would like to help, I need to better understand that. Again, I think we want you, the CSPs, whether you partner with the incumbent utility or you're out there on your own, we want you to have a level playing field in that marketplace.
Yes, we definitely prefer no exclusions, but I think that there was some comments in the Act that seemed to open up that possibility. But our druthers are obviously that we would like everything bid on a pay-for-performance basis to a third-party provider.
Okay. Another question, and I want to thank Ed Gray, who I met with about a month ago. One of the concerns I have is we're in the implementation phase of Act 129 is, and Carolyn, I think you just alluded to it, having protocols in place for the metering. My biggest fear, and we commend PPL for their advanced rollout pre-Act 129, but giving these companies guidance on the technology platform that they should be purchasing, procuring, as we get into full implementation or deployment of smart meters. So, Ed, I'm going to defer to you on that. We talked about the Maryland Commission. I thought it was a very straightforward approach, but your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I think we have to, I guess the buzzwords are open systems and interoperability. And I think you have to think about what those really are. I think if we think about interoperability, we can look at our house and we have probably three examples. You know, if we have a home area network for office work, that probably works pretty well. You know, it probably works reasonably seamlessly once we set it up to begin with. Our home area network for entertainment is probably the other end of the spectrum. You know, we have six remotes on our coffee table, and, you know, the only way we could fix that particular problem would be to buy, you know, throw everything away that we have and buy a home entertainment system that has every single component made by the same company and recognize that 2 years from now, maybe we'd have to throw it all out over again, because even if we bought something from the same company, you know, it probably wouldn't work with that company's equipment 2 years from now. So I think those are the extremes we want to work within. And the actually the application that we've talked about here and the one that really matters is the energy management function. As I indicated, the utilities are requiring AMI providers basically to provide interoperable systems with the meter and the, you know, in-home display, thermostats, and load control switches all operate together. So I think we're kind of over some of that hurdle. We're not over the hurdle of white goods that work together. Will we ever be? I don't really know. But I think we're sort of over the hurdle of the energy management system. On the other side of the electric meter, back at the utility, I think we have to understand that an electric utility is an industrial entity. They have a bunch of systems that run inside them. They may operate all working together on an enterprise system, or they may not. So when we deal with that side of it, again, it's not definitely not a plug-and-play situation. We have to walk into whatever utility has, and we have systems, and help them integrate those, sort of a precursor to a smart grid sort of technology and business model. So I think the areas where we've made progress, energy management in the home, I think that's a good thing, and maybe that's enough. I think that's like 50% of the load in the home or something like that. It's those loads. The other 50% is the other stuff, you know, white goods, plug loads, those kind of things. I don't know, did that help, sir?
Yes.
Okay.
Doug Bloom, thank you for your testimony. From an economic development perspective, I think you hit on something that might have to be discussed with our folk in the Department of Community and Economic Development. But, you know, if I were down in southeastern Pennsylvania talking to the folk at Brandywine Realty Trust or Liberty Property Trust, you know, we talk about LEED certified building design, but you've taken it to the goal line here in terms of should we be taking, you know, if there's economic economic incentives on the table for a company to relocate here? Should we look at mandates or working with the real estate investment trust folk on setting targets for them in terms of energy efficiency at the work site? An example, let's say Vanguard were to create 5,000 new jobs in Chester County, which I hope someday they'll do, but their new building off the Downingtown exit of the Turnpike, you know, they would, as part of their economic incentive or package, the state could come in and say, okay, by the way, we have under Act 129, we want to see you implement, you know, a 3% target within your own business in terms of energy conservation.
The question there is baseline.
Hold on.
I'm sorry. Maybe I don't want this on the record. The question there is baseline. I think the comment I made was that the estimate from ACEEE is 20% of the energy spent in existing buildings for leased office space. Leased office space is energy waste, and that's because most owners and operators, REITs, look at energy improvements and say, my tenant gets all the benefit. In terms of new design, there's been estimates that at least most of the buildings that are being designed today, large office buildings, are on the order of 50% less efficient than they could be over standard efficiency. So if you look at standard efficiency and where they're going, they could be 50% more efficient. So in terms of the policy of Pennsylvania, and there's issues with Pennsylvania's own buildings. We've done some exploration there as well, and there's a program undergoing to improve the efficiency of existing buildings. But in terms of incentives that are given to companies to come to Pennsylvania, you could couple that incentive with energy efficiency to say, let's commingle where these people are going to sit, you know, put their butts in the chairs, and make sure that the lighting is up to standards. And that includes such things as going beyond. I think one of the things that, and then Vice Chairman Christie, you did say that you want to go for the low-hanging fruit. I think there's a custodial responsibility the Commission has to say, where are we going in this world? And where we're going is to controlled energy, managed energy. So whatever you can do to not only get the low-hanging fruit, but also to lay the bricks for where we need to go, where we need to go in 5 years, because if we don't start working on 5 years today and start thinking like we're going there, we won't go there. We'll be eclipsed. There's a heck of an opportunity here. So you can combine incentives for moving here with incentives to make your operating costs go down. You can say to REITs, let's create a program like we've done in other jurisdictions with other utilities. You can do them statewide to say, let's target specific customer segments which we know to be operating at poor energy efficiency and target them with specific programs to go through and audit every building, whole building by the way, audit every building and then create incentive opportunities for them to make change. But it really comes down to the Commission saying we're demanding change. We're demanding meaningful change, not change that dissipates because you commission it and it goes away in 6 months. But we want to change the systems in these buildings, we want to change the behaviors, we want to change the education. And it really comes down a lot to customer segment specific education at times and putting money aside for that and moving it forward. I'm sorry I'm long-winded.
No, you're right on. And just some food for thought, is this going after those sacred cows like the municipal planning code and the statewide building code? I mean...
No, I think you guys have an opportunity to say, that's great. That's what they, you know, that's what the building minimum is. But we're going to incent people to go beyond. We're going to incent people to think about, you know, 2010 and beyond, 2013 and beyond, 2015 and beyond. Because a lot of these systems, you put in an environmental system today, it's there for 15 years. You put in an EMS system, and most EMS systems, one of the challenges with energy efficiency, building engineers are concerned with safety, operations, and maintenance. Who is concerned in that building day in, day out about energy efficiency? Practically no one. So maybe the Commission needs to consider about incenting companies or services to come out which do continuous monitoring, energy efficiency, carbon footprint, but to take energy management out of the boiler room and put it in the boardroom, and make it an asset management aspect as much as it is an operational management today.
Appreciate your insight. And before I wrap up, just for the record, everyone, at my household, we've tinted our windows, we have digitally controlled thermostats, and we've done CFL. So I've got one up on my colleague there, and we'll go down the line after that. So that concludes my comments. And thank you all for your presentations here today. Thanks.
Commissioner Pittsengrilli.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming. I think we all have many questions for each and every one of you, but unfortunately with our time constraints. But we're fortunate to have our implementation team scattered throughout the audience. I see Wayne Williams back there jotting down questions all day. So what you don't get today in questions, you certainly will get over the coming weeks, and we look forward to working with you. I'll just limit myself to a few questions. Pennsylvania Home Energy, Greg. I think on your slide you say you receive 50 to 80 consumer inquiries a week. What kind of questions are you getting? Where does a typical consumer become aware of the programs, and do you have enough resources to fulfill all the requests that you
have? Our program manager, Kathy Greeley, is sitting right here. I'll let her answer that.
Pop in. Hi. Most of those inquiries come in either through our 800 number or we have a website that they come in through, and we get everything from low-income customers looking for direction to, you know, low-income weatherization programs, to consumers asking about where we can get an audit for their homes, to how they can find someone to do insulation or an infrared scan. And so we return those calls, and what we're primarily doing is pushing them out to the contractors that have been trained through our program to deal with their needs in their home.
Okay. Do you feel there's enough contractors out there now to handle all the requests?
Our program is 16 months old at this point. We've gone from there being, you know, less than 5 certified contractors in the state of Pennsylvania to over 60 in the past 16 months. And our program is a slightly over a $1 million program. This is not a big, huge program. We've done 9 or 10 rounds of training in the past year all around the state. And so we think that, are we where we ultimately need to be to serve all the homes in Pennsylvania? No. But do we have people all across the state to deal with consumers' inquiries at this point? Yeah. We're in a much better place than we were a year ago.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Elster. Let's see. Was that Ed, Mr. Gray?
Yes.
You talked about stakeholder tests typically used, and we've received some comments from others who submitted testimony that aren't speaking today, but talk about the societal cost test. Can you expand a little bit on the three, the participant, the total resource, and societal?
Right. As folks have indicated, the TRC is typically used as the test to make the commission decision upon. And what's been done a lot of places is to try to get as close to the societal test as possible with things you can reasonably quantitatively measure or calculate. Because a lot of times you think about a societal test, you're going to talk about, are we making the business more efficient? You know, is the public getting more efficient? And, you know, all these kind of things that are hard to quantify. But typically what's done is to take things like environmental control technologies and put a price tag on those, because we know what they cost, you know, for SO2 control, NOx control, particulates, whatever. So for those cases, we can sort of do the TRC test analysis and toss in a few of those societal costs that we can quantify readily. And that was what was done in Maryland for several of the cases for IOUs at that point. Now, the participant test is the other one that's frequently used, and that is, are the people participating in the test getting value for their participation? And there, too, typically that's a very positive thing. The question that comes up, and one of the other people on the panel brought that up, was what happens with the non-participants? And that's really been a problematic in Maryland, for example. And so what you need to do for the non-participants to benefit is you need to get the peak price down on PGM significantly. If you can do that, in other words, a big load reduction, in that case, even people who don't participate and still pay through rates for the AMI or whatever else is out there benefit anyway, because the system as a whole reduces costs. If you just piecemeal put AMI in for anybody who wants one, you don't get that large benefit, so you really can't, you know, participate and benefit under those kind of circumstances unless you're like a large industrial user, and those people are already doing it, of course.
Okay. Thank you.
Welcome.
Question for Mr. Garland. You talked about some of the pilot programs and that we should focus on starting some in Pennsylvania. Can you just mention one or two that you think are most successful in some of the other states and what kind of customers were involved in the pilots?
Sure. A couple of the programs that have been most successful, there's the SCORE program, which is Schools Conserving Resources, which has been tremendously successful, especially in Texas and in Arkansas. I think last year alone, Texas school districts, and it was just on a pilot basis before it launched in full, saved about 15 megawatts of peak demand. There have also been a number of solutions-based programs by taking a whole building approach, a commercial solutions program and a residential solutions. I've heard my two colleagues take two ends of the spectrum, and what we've tried to say is in some of the markets, the contractor skill set is not high enough that you can take them all the way to where you want them to be, so why start with that leap? Let's start in the middle first and take that leap and move them along so that you can improve the skills and attitudes and their knowledge base. So we tried to do that with the residential solutions program. One of the things that's made that so successful is the question that was just pointed out a minute ago is how do you get homeowners to do something? And we can certainly talk about it offline or another time, but part of what we do in that process is actually close and qualify the customer prior to actually doing the assessment so that we know what their attitude is towards making the investment in the facilities. In some of the other programs, we find that, and there's been a lot of talk about incentives, if you look at what are the barriers to adopting energy efficiency, first cost doesn't even make it in the top five in most cases. People don't know what to buy, they don't know how to buy, they don't know what they need. Programs that really help focus on improving the owner's skills in that set, both in the commercial industrial sector and also for the residential sector, and how to hire a contractor, and what are the expectations that you should have for the contractor. Those are the skills, and that's why I was talking before about sometimes just giving them the information isn't enough. You've got to take it a step further and engage them in the process. Those are the things that we focus on.
How do you think we need to get information, and who is the right party to get the information out to, say, school districts and healthcare facilities who know they need to make behavioral and structural changes and they don't know where to start?
Colleague here mentioned a minute ago, one of the things that works very well that we've used quite effectively is actually the competitive aspect of it. If we get one school district in one area to participate, I can get all of them to participate because no one wants to be outpaced by their peers. The process that we do there is more than just mailing information. It's actually engaging them in the process so that they have an expectation that there is an expectation on them to actually participate in the process. It's not enough to just want to improve. You've got to take some action steps. And those are the things that we do is, you know, when we engage them, we go out en masse, invite them, let them know what the program expectations are, and that the services will be there to move them along if they want to move. If they don't want to move, then we need to work with the people that do.
And do you see the Commonwealth playing any role in, I mean, you're talking about the marketing aspect, do you see the Commonwealth playing any role in educating?
The Commonwealth can play a huge role, and one of the critical aspects in all of what we're talking about here today is the value of how you take the information and integrate it in the programs that both the Commonwealth currently has, things that are being done at the federal level, and that's really what good program implementation is about, is finding how do you direct all of the resources to the participants in the program in such a way that you fully engage them in that process. And it really varies depending on if you're talking about public schools or cities and counties or commercial office buildings. There's a whole wide range here, and there are sort of value propositions and programs that are established that are out there. It's integrating them and bringing them together in a meaningful way, not just integrating for integration's sake, but to drive the customer to actually make a decision and move forward with energy efficiency.
I appreciate it. I appreciate everyone being here. You each brought a different perspective to us today, and we'll certainly take your comments under consideration as we move forward.
Commissioner Gardner?
I don't have much to add, except that I did need to respond to the Vice Chairman's earlier comments that having so many providers and advisors here is has the potential of being somewhat confusing. I'm actually very excited because it says to me that conservation in Pennsylvania is doable. It is doable in a readily available off-the-shelf technology with proven suppliers. And I'm very happy to have you all here today.
Chairman Cawley?
Well, first of all, I'd like to address this whole house approach and recognize Pennsylvania Home Energy and also Affordable Comfort, Inc. We have Pennsylvania homegrown entities here that are doing work, lonely work in the vineyards, if I might add, with a relatively small amount of money, but they're doing great things. Stemming, by the way, from original funding from the electric restructuring, where agreed amount of monies were set aside, capable people were appointed to these boards, and they have done great work. The West Penn Power Sustainable Energy Fund conceived the original idea for what is now Keystone Help, which the Pennsylvania Treasurer administers, where low-interest loans are afforded to people to improve the efficiency and conservation in their homes. Part of the problem, as Commissioner Pizzengrilli has already noted, is that we don't have enough yet people trained in order to do the home audits, and that's where Helen Perrine and Affordable Comfort comes into play. So thank you both, and thanks Joel Morrison and the others involved in those programs. We're going to hear from Roger Clark in a few minutes, who is with the Reinvestment Fund in Philadelphia. They're doing much the same work. For instance, they have chosen the supermarket industry as a targeted industry to achieve the types of goals we're talking about here. Let me switch to the idea of what works and what doesn't work. Ed Gray, I've asked Lori to put your slides back up here again. Would you go over your first few slides, 6 and 7, I believe?
Yeah, certainly.
What works in Maryland and what doesn't work?
Okay, this one was the one from the Brattle Group again, and these were different, an illustration that you need price and technology to get the highest peak load reduction. And the next one was the voting that we did at the BWI Airport. Do you want to get onto some of those tests like the other commissioner did, sir, or what was your...
This particular slide was noteworthy. If I read it correctly, the most effective, in these people's view, most effective method was direct control.
No, this is voting. This is not rank order. Those are just the way the questions were posed. So if you look down at the fourth item, that had 44 votes. The first one had 8 votes. These aren't rank ordered by the number of votes. They just, you know, these were the way the questions were asked. So, in other words, the X number of people in the room were asked to vote on these electronic devices. Of the four things, what did they think would be most effective in PJM? And 44 voters said AMI with automated demand response. And then 22 said more CNI demand response through CSPs. And then 14 said smart meters, just driving demand on a price basis as opposed to having the smart thermostats, whatever, to go along with it. And then 8 people voted for more direct DLC at the residential level. So that was how the vote was held, and that was, you know, those were the results.
It's interesting that most of those polled thought that automatic demand response would be most effective. Am I reading that correctly? Number 4?
Right, and that was driven through the AMI infrastructure.
Right. Well, which is interesting because Pennsylvania's electric cooperatives are doing just that with the consent of their owners, which are their customers.
Right.
Where they've given the consent for automatic controls on their heaters and air conditioners and the like. We have just a few minutes here before the next panel. Cliff, you were hurried because you were last. I would like you to slowly utter your 4 points next to the microphone and give the panel an opportunity to disagree or agree with you.
Now, fine.
No. Would you move the mic close? Thank you.
Well, the first recommendation for the commission is to have whole house residential energy efficiency audits as a requirement to get access to other significant funding, to replace HVAC, to have an on-site renewable generation, to make sure, as a number of the panelists have said, you've got to have the house tight, it has to be insulated properly for all the other measures to take advantage of their capabilities. Point two is, learn from other states, learn from the past, and when you're constructing a residential energy audit program, look at the consumer. Consumers have clearly said, we want choice in terms of the types of people that come and do the audit. There are many people who don't want the contractor. They do want an independent opinion. In many cases, consumers simply will not pay $500 or cannot afford to pay $500 for an audit. We've seen in many states that lower-priced audits, whether subsidized or simply a lower out-of-pocket cost, is a much better way to ramp up and get participation. Three, we're talking about having information that consumers can understand and act on. And we talked about financing. One of the things that my company has found that's very, very powerful is to look at length of loan, not term. Look at term of loan, not rate. Because knocking the rate down a couple of points has a minimal impact on monthly payment. If you extend the term, however, you can drive it down significantly. And when people are looking at whether they can afford energy efficiency improvements, they look at it like they spend money in any other way, which is on a monthly basis. You look at a car payment in terms of how much it costs you each month. You look at paying for that high-definition television on a per-month basis. If you position energy efficiency in a way with long-term financing so that it costs less than it saves each month, and we have an algorithm in our software that does that calculation, that you're much more likely to get somebody to do the install measure when they can save more than it actually costs. And you have to provide that analysis and that information and make the comparison to people and have the financing available as well. I think the fourth point, and we've talked a lot about contractors and having enough skilled people to do the work, we recommend a more inclusive approach. I'm certainly not criticizing the standards that ResNet and BPI have. I criticize that the cost and expense involved in getting there, but their standards are fine. But that's back to Vice Chairman Christie's point. That's going with a BMW or a Cadillac. There's a lot of the work that can be done very, very capably by people who don't have to go through that level of training. And we recommend that alternative standards in terms of criteria and experience and so on be set up that are less costly for people to meet.
Okay.
And then just in closing, I have nothing at all against the Energy Star brand. Great brand. In fact, our program would love to work with them because they've got some brand recognition. It's just in this particular case, it's the devil is in the detail. It's all about implementation, and it's those little things that you do with a consumer that have a huge impact because they can say yes or no.
Okay, and now in fairness, does anybody have a response?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my.
I guess just philosophically, one thing that was said was require home audits, for example, and then a couple of people on the commission, a couple of the commissioners actually mentioned that it's wonderful that we have all of these technologies to pick from, and I guess I would like to submit that it's really not the role or objective of the commission or any of us necessarily to pick the technologies that work, because utilities have a habit of pilotitis, which we call. And not to require home audits or not to require this or that. What the objective is to find peak load reduction and base load reduction through energy efficiency and demand response. So what I'd like to throw out philosophically, and again it's coming back to the whole idea of pay for performance, the commission and everyone else should be agnostic as far as the technology. What we have to do is provide results as providers of curtailment services. So I I don't think dictating how to do that or what technology to be used or whether or not to require home audits is a necessary thing. I think that the whole objective here is to find megawatts in peak load reduction and to find megawatts in energy efficiency or base load reduction.
And pay for performance means?
Pay for performance means to put all of that risk on the curtailment service provider from a capital standpoint, and to impose penalties if those megawatts are not delivered on a peak load reduction basis or on a base load reduction basis for energy efficiency. So it takes the burden off completely of deciding on technology. It should be technology agnostic. It should be up to the curtailment service providers to figure out how to deliver that those reductions on both the energy efficiency side and demand response side, and to impose penalties. That's what capitalism is all about. Let us figure out how to do that and penalize us if we're not able to perform under a contract.
Well, the Act specifically mentions conservation service providers must be a part of every program. So you are going to play a vital part in this program by legislative mandate. Anybody else?
Yeah. Greg Thomas with PA Home Energy. Thanks. I think there are a few different points here. One goes to the training necessary to install, to assess buildings and install materials and equipment correctly for operation. And that's not trivial. It is in terms of both savings. Just simply installing insulation without necessarily identifying the air leakage locations that could bypass that insulation, you don't see the kinds of savings. So by introducing performance testing, we get a much higher level of savings out of buildings. But that requires training. It requires infrared camera. It doesn't. It's enhanced by infrared cameras to find those locations, etc. So there's reasons in terms of savings for the performance testing and the assessment process and the training associated with that. Secondly, we've tossed around a cost of $500 to do an audit. We've also talked a lot about marketplaces. In a more evolved market, we see service providers offering full home performance audits with performance testing, infrared cameras, and everything for free. And you can see TV commercials for this any day of the week up in New York State. And that's a more evolved market around this. And that's because they're recouping their cost of that investigation of the building based on pre-qualifying the customer and for loans and then going into the building and selling the services. So they're able, the upfront cost of this is a market function. It's not a given that these will cost $500. In terms of how information is presented, I entirely agree. Consumers operate on a cash flow basis, and that's important that they have information like that, that you be able to show what the cash flow will be if you take a loan. If the loan programs can offer extended periods, that's great as well. And in terms of program cost, I think we've actually demonstrated in Pennsylvania that it is possible to launch one of these programs cost effectively and get that market development, and that's a sunk cost at this point that can be leveraged by subsequent programs.
One more. Anybody else? Jeremy, I was going to save you for last anyway, because you've demonstrated another way it works.
Yeah, just commenting on a couple of things that I've heard. One of the challenges that we've seen in some other states with whom we're working, both with the commissions and with the utilities, how do you scale with a scalpel? I mean, we need to get to millions and millions of homes. It's not going to be enough to get to a few thousand homes or even 10,000 homes or 100,000 homes. There are 300 million people in this country. And how do we engage them in the proper way, and how do we get them to start taking, even if it's baby steps? I'm all for doing the whole home, but we're not going to get to 100 million whole homes in the next 4 years. We're just not. It's just not going to happen. So leveraging information that the utilities have today that about their customers, other information that's available, really will allow the utilities to start to, as we say internally, scale with a scalpel. How do you very quickly understand what each home needs? Some homes are further along than others, and start to get the benefits. It's not going to be enough to wait 5 or 10 years till all the advanced devices are in, or 15 years to get the benefits. You know, you need to start getting the benefits tomorrow, and of course we'll continue to get more and more benefit over time. That was my only comment.
May I respond to that?
Doug?
Just to reemphasize, don't forget the commercial industrial. I mean, if every home is a blueberry, it takes a lot of blueberries to add up to the weight of an elephant. And if you take any knowledge from the experience of telecommunications companies, the CLECs, when they were trying to build out, a lot of CLECs went after the consumer. And they spent a lot of money going after consumer. I think Mr. Chisty down there can talk about the amount of capital he's put in to go after the consumer market. Once it's up and running, it's a guaranteed event every month. But in order to get results fast, the CNI is an important part of your introduction of these programs, so don't forget them. I think the only other comment is, if people on this panel are up for it, maybe you want to grab a few and keep them on hook on a regular basis to help advise or at least comment on some of the directions that you're taking, because we don't have time to do it over. So if you don't have the time to do it right, I mean, do it over, take the time and do it right, so we might be able to help confuse you as we go along. Right, Mr. Christie?
Yes. All right, with that, thank you, Judge. Let's take a 10-minute, no more, break, and we'll go with the next panel.
All right, we will.